Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, February 11th. We do not have a quorum yet, so we'll start. The first order of business will be House File 65 with Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson, welcome to the committee. When we get a quorum here, we will. I'll move your bill for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I'll be really, really brief. What I'm doing with House File 65 is increasing the credit amount for the angel investor credit from $15 million to $18 million. You'll see, I think that I have an amendment on there.
Representative Anderson, we do have a quorum now, so I will officially call the meeting to order. Representative Gunther moves approval of the minutes dated February 10th. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The chair will move House File 65 be recommended to pass and refer to the Tax Committee.
Yes.
All right, and the chair will also move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the form that the author would like. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. So the bill is now in the format that you would like, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So members, with the Angel Investor Tax Credit, if you're not familiar with it, what it is it's a financing tool that a lot of the startup companies across the state of Minnesota use to get their operations underway. We have some great examples across the state of innovation that's been happening because of the Angel Investor Tax Credit, which was first put in place by Representative Mahoney and Representative Dabney. I think it was back in 2010. And I think it's been a very well-utilized program, and I'm just extending it and also making sure that we have more funds available to it so that we can see more innovation and jobs created through this program. And with that, Mr. Chair, I do have some folks that are willing to testify if you wish.
Okay. Representative Wagenius.
Just a question, if I could. Are you actually adding money to the pot here?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, yes.
And
Representative Wagenius.
And how much is that going to be?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Wagenius, it's $3 million, excuse me. It's going from $15 million to $18 million.
Representative Wagenius.
No, I think I'm asking a different question. This is how much is allowed. So it's a tax expenditure, right? Is that it?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what the state does is we have a pot of money that is allocated for use for those that could access tax credit. And so this is money that's set aside for the tax credit. It's exhausted every year, and this is adding more to the fund so that more people can access it.
Representative Wagenius.
Oh, well, I think we're getting to the question I have. So the tax committee, you are asking the tax committee to make the pot of money available larger?
Well, at this point, Representative Wagenius, Representative Anderson's asking us to pass this bill to send it to the tax committee so she can ask the tax committee to expand the research and development tax credit. But that's more of a process question. But did you have a follow-up question?
Well, the issue would be if we expanded the amount available and we didn't get a larger tax credit allocation, then we would be serving fewer people. I mean, I'm not a, because you have, we have to have the money available.
Okay, well, this will not come out of our target in this committee, Representative Guinness. It would come out of the tax committee's target. But Representative Anderson, did you have a follow-up on that?
I get that.
Maybe I can help out. So this is a different tax credit. This isn't like the K-12 education credit. What we do is we have a fund that provides the angel investor tax credit. And once those dollars in that fund are gone, anybody that comes afterwards looking for that tax credit is not eligible for it. So the funds were first exhausted in August, the first year that was put in place. Then I believe it was July, then May, and then finally March. So each year it's been exhausted at a quicker pace than it was in the year before.
Representative Wagenius.
Okay. I'm just going to make sure, now, and this is new for me. So this is $18 million per person or per corporation or in the whole pot?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's for the entire pot. Each angel investor group, each business that is utilizing it, there's a cap. So, no, nobody's going to get $18 million. There's a cap on how much you can access.
Okay. Representative Vigenius, did you have an amendment to make it $18 million per person? Or
no, but, you know, there are some businesses that would surely like $18 million.
Sure.
I get it. Thank you.
Seeing no other discussion, the chair renews his motion to have House File 65 be recommended to pass. And Representative Mahoney.
Are you going to have testifiers for this
particular bill? Only if you wish, Mr. Chair.
Only if we need to, and I don't think we need to, Representative Mahoney.
I have a couple of comments.
Sure, go ahead.
Representative Anderson, can you explain the requirements for a qualified investor?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, so for the investors, here are the qualifications as pulled from the Department of Employment and Economic Development. First, for the investors, they need to be a natural person. They need to be accredited investor per SEC Rule 501. They need to be a non-accredited investor investing in exempt filings. They need to be of the business in which the investment may be. It can't be any family and so forth. That was legislation that you guys passed last year. They have to be certified by deed before investment is made, and they have to make a minimum qualifying investment of $10,000.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, an accredited investor, do you, under the 501 Securities and Exchange Rule, do you know what qualifies that person underneath Rule 501?
Representative Anderson, do you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we have staff here, they might be able to give them all the details, if that's possible.
Well, we are taking up the economic development portion of this bill, not the tax side of it, so we don't have any tax staff here today. But certainly we can have staff write that question down and refer it to tax staff and get an answer to... Oh, Nina Manzi is? I'm sorry. Would you like to approach and offer your thoughts? Sorry. Maybe you can arm wrestle over it.
Yeah.
And Representative Mahoney and members of the committee, we have our Department of Commerce overview today, too. And I do not want to have to bring the commissioner and staff back later for an afternoon hearing. So we would just ask members to kind of keep that in mind. We want to be respectful of Commerce's time. So that's why if you sense that I'm trying to move things along.
I promise to be shorter than I was in Representative Gunther's committee.
Well, that's a lot of leeway, Representative Mahoney. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nina Manzi from the House Research Department. I have a document from the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is available on their website that I can make available to the committee. That's an investor bulletin that describes what an accredited investor is. I'll just read the first part, which is it's set up as a series of questions. There's one that says, "Are you an accredited investor?" And then it says, an accredited investor in the context of a natural person includes anyone who, one, earned income that exceeded $200,000 or $300,000 together with a spouse in each of the two prior years and reasonably expects the same for the current year, or two, has a net worth over $1 million either alone or together with a spouse, excluding the value of the person's primary residence. So those are the two big tests, and we'll see if Mr. Nelson has anything to add to that.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Jeff Nelson. I work for the Department of Employment and Economic Development and manage the Angel Tax Credit Program. And yes, those are the criteria that we use in certifying investors to participate in the program.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, my question would be for Representative Anderson, not the testifiers.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, Representative Anderson, you understand that what the qualifications of an accredited investor is. Have you done your research on, because we had this conversation in Representative Gunther's committee, on where these investments are being made, and this is where I'm getting to the economic development piece in the state. I mean, so do you know how many are made in the metro area versus greater Minnesota?
Representative Anderson.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's two in two harbors that have asked to be qualified businesses for it. There's one in Cokato, one in Red Wing, one in two in Rushford, one in Mankato, one in Byron, another one in Mankato. That's just for 2015. For those that are qualified businesses for 2014, you've got Pine City. You have another two harbors, Scanlon, Faribault, Austin. You have St. Michael, but some wouldn't consider that a greater Minnesota one. And I know that was one of your concerns. We have two from Rochester. We've got one from St. Peter, Red Wing, another one from Rochester, Duluth, and Mankato.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair, and this you can go to the Minnesota Deeds website, the Angel Investment Tax Credit list of qualified and get a list of the qualified investors. And just this year, I believe there's almost as many, if not more, qualified businesses in Plymouth than there are in all of greater Minnesota. But my real concern with this particular program, and one of the reasons I wanted I want people to understand what this program has been doing, is 90% of the dollars spent in this program are spent from Edina, Eden Prairie up to Maple Grove. I like to call it the Golden Crescent, because they really do not invest anywhere else. It is really a problem. We have regularly told the VC community that they need to do a better job, and I've told them that since the first, and they have not managed to do that for whatever reason. I get a lot of secondary explanations on it, like, well, you know, we're going where the best deal is. We couldn't find any out there. The credits ran out before. So last year we put $7 million or $7.5 million into a Greater Minnesota Fund. And this year we're going to put more money in, and we're not changing the Greater Minnesota dollar figure. So, you know, I could go on this. This has been a thorn in my side for a variety of reasons, most that I've brought to. I will just leave it at that, Mr. Chair, and ask members to vote no on this particular bill. They now already get $60 million in angel investment credits, investments, not credits. And when this bill was first done, this was a first or maybe a second, rarely a second round of angels that was going to be used on this. And now, time and time again, they come back for this for a second round of angel investments using this particular piece. Again, we're moving rich people's risk onto the public. And frankly, for my friends on the other side of the aisle, I know you campaigned on helping middle-class people. This is a bill, this is a program that helps millionaires. So if you vote yes on this, you're voting to help millionaires versus helping to you know, the poor guy that's living in a trailer park out in somewhere in greater Minnesota. So, Mr. Chair, I'll be done. I'd ask people to vote no on this bill.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, did you want to respond or go to further member questions and comments?
We can go to further questions.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question, I think, is for Representative Anderson, and I apologize for having my back to you. But I wonder if you have some information, or if Deed is here and can provide some information or some data on the number of jobs that we've created through this program over the last couple of years. And the second part to that question would be, I think that as we had the discussion over the last 2 years about the changes that we made to this program, which I did support because we directed 50% of the funds to greater Minnesota. My second part of the question would be, what have we done for marketing in greater Minnesota? Because I do believe that was part of the conversation about how we promote investment in greater Minnesota and minority-owned companies.
Representative Anderson, we have someone from Deed, first of all, for the first question. Again, please state your restate your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff Nelson from running the Angel Tax Credit Program for DEED. I'm sorry, I don't have the number of jobs created. I don't have that information with me. That is in our report to the legislature, which is on our website. I know it's, we divide it into two different ways. One is the direct jobs created by those businesses. That means W-2 employees that they have. That has not really met our expectations. It is several hundred jobs. So we also started then asking these businesses, well, what other jobs are you creating? Because many of these are very small, just startup companies. They don't put people on their payroll. Instead, they are hiring consultants, some software designers, developers, that type of thing. And we found that there was many more thousands of people that were employed that in that fashion. But we can get to that information, Representative. In terms of the second question, in terms of marketing, starting this year, 2015, we have the $15 million in credits available. Half of that amount starting this year is carved out for women-owned businesses, minority-owned businesses, and businesses located in greater Minnesota. As part of that carve-out effort, starting as of January this year, late last year we began a promotion campaign. It's a multifaceted campaign. It included newspaper ads in greater Minnesota newspapers, newspapers targeted toward minorities and for women. It also involved an email campaign to economic developers around greater Minnesota to make sure that they were aware of the carve-out. We've also done outreach programs. When I say they or we, I mean me. So I've been out presenting to various organizations just to let them know about this carve-out, that there's money available, that with the carve-out, the biggest benefit is that, as Senator Anderson, Representative Anderson said earlier, last year we ran out of money in March. With this carve-out for the specific groups, that will mean that that money will last longer. So we're anticipating it could last perhaps the whole year, maybe, well, just till September at least, because that's when it'll go back into the regular pot. So it's been a multifaceted promotional campaign, and it's not done yet.
Ms. Newman, I believe you have the answer to the first question. You just happen to have it memorized off the top of your head, correct?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I have the 2013 annual report that Mr. Nelson was referring to. And according to that, the 2010 direct job creation number was 58. The 2011 number was 175. The 2012 number was 153. And the 2013 number was 57. And for 2013, there is an indirect hire number in the report of 571.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, those are interesting numbers. And I think, you know, I really don't mind the Angel Investment Program against my friend across the way there, Representative Mahoney. I think there's some sense in it, but I do think that this committee should really consider the implications of the policy itself. Because if you take those numbers that we just heard and the numbers of jobs created, and you do the math with the numbers of dollars we've invested in credits, I don't know that that's the best value for Minnesota. That being said, I think it would be wise if we took another biennium's worth of data and looked at the changes that were made over the last 2 years and what will happen, you know, 2 years from now. And we can make some educated decisions on the policy itself. But members, I'm guessing that that's not going to happen, and I'm thinking that we're going to move to a vote here very shortly. And I just want to remind you, for those of you that ran on supporting Greater Minnesota, that a yes vote for this bill will essentially add $3 million, new dollars, to the Metro pot. And you can see by the data that's provided on the DEED website about qualified businesses, and you can even circle a nice circle around, or a crescent shape, I guess I would say, around the West Metro. So a yes vote, essentially you're adding $3 million to qualified investors who, as we heard testimony, make a minimum of $200,000 a year over the last 2 years, but you're supporting Metro. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Simonson and other members of the committee. For the month of January, already $1.5 million has been taken from the carve-out fund. That was as of 2 weeks ago. I'm guessing the number is even higher today. So those folks that are part of the carve-out, that includes Greater Minnesota, women-owned businesses, and minority-owned businesses, they've already spent $1.5 million from the fund.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, have you made any attempts to expand the angel investment program to middle-class investors so it's not just the program oriented towards the wealthy?
Representative Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, everyone can access this. We had in the Representative Gunther's committee a fellow who came up. He was a University of Minnesota student, and he had an idea to create an app that is basically the college version of Groupon. And he has been so successful that retailers that participated in his app had their runs on their stores, essentially. And now he is so successful in doing this that he is going nationwide in the next year. Those are the kind of stories. Those are the people that we're helping here today. Small-time folks that wouldn't be able to access this kind of capital to make their dreams a reality. If we want to limit this to only people that can have access to a bank account, to that kind of traditional source of funding to get their business off the ground, that's the vote you're going to be taking if you vote no against this bill. But if you are truly looking to help the folks that just don't have that kind of access, vote for this bill.
Representative Scott.
I'll pass.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to clarify, I'm new to this process a little bit, so I'm still learning, and what it sounded like you said was a college student access the funds, and that would be then a college student that has an annual salary of $200,000 a year or $1 million in the bank. Is that correct?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, he is one of the innovators. He has a business that he started, and he cannot get a loan through a bank, a traditional
right.
system. And so because of the angel investors that invested in his business, he has been able to expand that, and now he's going nationwide.
So he found
Representative Isaacs.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, sir. So he had found people that were able to meet the investor criteria to fund that. But I think the question that was asked was, what about the folks that want to invest and get involved that aren't making that much money?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, if they are part of an LLC through a pass-through entity, they would be able to access the funds and go through that route. So if you want, you can go to the DEEDS website, mm-hmm. and it tells you all about the different ways that you can utilize the Angel Investor Tax Credit.
Representative Mahoney, or I'll go to Representative Mahoney, and then Commerce staff, I don't think we're going to be able to get these two bills done as quickly as I originally thought, so I'm going to have staff. I think 200 should be available. If you want to check and see if 200 is available, we will reconvene the committee for planning probably 5 o'clock tonight, 5 or 5:30. So just keep an eye on your emails for staff. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. A no vote to this on this particular bill is not denying access. It is denying an increase of $3 million on top of the $15 million that is available today. So we are not denying access to the angel investment credit, or, in other words, the $60 million that's available with the present program. We are just denying an extra $12 million in investment, or $3 million more, for someone who has a net worth of $100 million or an income of $200,000 for the past 2 years and reasonably expects to have a $200,000 income next year. So you've nicely put words together, but we are only denying the extra $3 million rather than angel investment access.
Representative Anderson, any closing comments?
No.
Well, the chair will offer some closing comments, and that is, I know the Angel Investor Credit Program has always had strong bipartisan support. I think Representative Kelleher actually played a major role in that being implemented back in 2012. And Representative Anderson, I want to thank you for moving forward in this legislation and expanding it and expanding economic opportunity across the state. So with that, the clerk will take the roll.
Garofalo.
Yes.
Baker.
Yes.
Mahoney.
No.
Clark is excused. Fabian.
Yes.
Gunther.
Yes.
Portman.
Aye.
Isaacson.
No.
Johnson.
No.
Lunin.
Yes.
Metza. Neuberger.
Yes.
O'Neill.
Yes.
Scott.
Yes.
Simonson.
No.
Smith.
Yes.
Swazinski.
Yes.
Vogel.
Yes.
Wagenius.
No.
There being 12 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails. You're on your way to taxes, Representative Anderson. The second bill we have is House File 66. The chair will move House File 66. Also be recommended to pass and referred to the Tax Committee. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What this does is it makes the Angel Investor Tax Credit permanent.
Thank you. Any discussion, members? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. The motion passes. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Good seeing you. Department of Commerce staff, Commissioner Rothman. Commissioner, did you bring any unclaimed property with you today?
I did. Peter, do we want to do that later? Do you want to do that now or later? You're funny.
You did.
You can ask me that later. I do have some information for the committee.
Is there anyone on the committee who'd be interested in it?
Oh, yeah.
Really? Okay, cool.
Do that now or later?
Let's do it now. Let's...
Mr. Chair, here, why don't we... Mr. Chair, you and I had a conversation last week and thought it would be interesting just to see. You know, the unclaimed property program in Minnesota is, as we talked about, and we will highlight this, is housed within the Department of Commerce. There's 1 in 20 Minnesotans that have unclaimed property that is $100 or more to their name. And or $100 or less. And so what we did is I thought it'd be an interesting exercise just to take the names of the committee members and run them against the unclaimed property database, and you'll see that some of your names actually pop up, and there's you may have unclaimed property waiting for you. I did this with my sister. I found that she had $100 or something of an old paycheck she forgot about that she never... heard about. The money's there. If you're interested in claiming that, anything that you might see there and you're interested in doing, our staff can help. But also we've beefed up and improved our electronic system of processing claims of unclaimed property. You can just go onto our website. It's called Missing Money. Put your name in and then it'll pop up and tell you what the amount of the claim is and all that. And so you can see these numbers popping up here. Some of it is old securities that are dividends or something like that. Sometimes it's an old utility bill payment that should have been returned to you or was offered to you and it was never claimed. Sometimes it's missing payroll checks. Sometimes it's insurance proceeds. We found thousands of dollars for policyholders who never knew that their parents or a family member had left them with insurance proceeds. So we do this annually. We have return tens of millions of dollars to Minnesotans every year, and that's a great program. So very pleased.
Commissioner, there's been a misunderstanding. I do not see my name on this list. because we are on TV today, just for people who are watching or for members of the committee, what is the website they can go to just key their name in to find out? And again, there's no charge for this. If anyone ever calls members of the public and says, you know, they got to pay $50 or $60, it's totally untrue. What's the website they go to find out if some of their money is out there?
So they go to the Minnesota Department of Commerce website. You just in the consumer area, you'll see the unclaimed property website, and go to Missing Money, or just type in to your website, Google, Minnesota Commerce, unclaimed property, or missing money, and it'll pop right up for you.
Good. So thanks for supplying this list. I thought it would just be interesting. Again, there are What's the total unclaimed balance right now, Commissioner? It's
well, the total is sheeted is in the hundreds of millions of dollars that's been turned over to the state for dozens of years. So it's a fair amount of money.
Thank you, Commissioner. So if you could begin your presentation, I apologize. Sure. We've only got about an hour 15. We'll try to get everything done by then. Otherwise, we'll come back at 5.
All right. So with your packets of materials, you'll have the agency overview and the governor's budget presentation materials that we've supplied to the committee. So I'll run through this slide deck and then some of the detailed background information on the base budget and change items. So we start with the Commerce Department's mission to protect the public interest, advocating on behalf of Minnesota's consumers, ensuring strong and competitive marketplaces for all of the industries that we regulate at the Department of Commerce, to work on strengthening our economic future and serving the public trust as a trusted public resource for consumers and businesses to contact us for help, assistance, and information. The Department of Commerce, on page 3, you'll see we regulate activity in more than 20 industries. The primary ones are insurance, securities, financial institutions, including state chartered banks, credit unions, personal lenders. And then also we license approximately 350,000 professionals and entities in Minnesota. We provide consumer affairs services, including phone services, and we also investigate both civil and criminal fraud on behalf of Minnesotans. We advocate for the public interest before regulated bodies, in particular the Public Utilities Commission, and we also deliver federal and state energy telecommunications programs to the state of Minnesota. The next page gives you sort of a broad overview of my leadership staff. Some of the folks are here with me today. Ann O'Connor is the Deputy Commissioner and Chief of Staff. Shane Deal is our Deputy Commissioner of Financial Institutions. With him is an Assistant Commissioner, Mary Jo Wall, who's been with the department for over 30 plus years. Tim Vandehey, Deputy Commissioner of Insurance, phenomenally experienced individual. We had the luck to come to Minnesota to work for us from Wisconsin. Bill Grant, our Deputy Commissioner for the Division of Energy Resources, as well, strong and deep with respect to all energy issues that we have. And Marty Fleischacker, who's worked at the department, I believe, over 10, 15 years going back. And has strong depth helping on civil investigations. He oversees the enforcement division, which I'll talk about in a few slides here. Turning to the next page, we have the financial institutions just division oversight. We ensure that state financial institutions are safe and financially solvent. We do that through the examination process. We watch the fundamentals, basically, of the financials of the state chartered institutions. They include state chartered banks, credit unions, mortgage companies, finance companies, and other financial institutions. So, for example, we have 262 state chartered banks. We have a large number of credit unions. And just quickly bounce another, you'll see this when we get to it, but we oversee about $50 billion of bank, credit union, and finance company assets that we regulate. The next slide shows you a little overview of our insurance division. The insurance area regulates Minnesota's insurance marketplace and insurance companies. It evaluates the insurance policies that are filed with the department that are used and sold to Minnesotans. The department also has a unit that looks at the rates that are filed to ensure fairness and compliance with our Minnesota statutes. And that's in all lines of insurance. We also have the licensing area. So, for example, we license all the insurance agents in Minnesota, as you may know. We do examination and regulate domestic and foreign insurance companies to ensure their safety and financial solvency. And as you know, we have some of the nation's largest insurance institutions or companies in the state of Minnesota. We ensure a strong and competitive and fair marketplace so that Minnesotans have the insurance needs that that they need. The Division of Energy Resources, on the next slide, ensures and focuses that the energy services throughout Minnesota are reliable and reasonably priced while minimizing adverse environmental impacts. We advocate for renewable and clean energy opportunities for Minnesotans. We advocate on behalf of consumers and ratepayers in proceedings involving regulated entities. Again, going to fast facts chart, just to point out, in 2013, our work led to about $384 million in savings for Minnesota ratepayers due to the recommendations the department made to keep energy rates low. The department oversees the conservation improvement programs operated by the public utilities, municipal and cooperative utilities, and we maintain the emergency planning and recovery plans for events of state emergencies or natural disasters involving energy. The division promotes energy efficiency in buildings, conservation, alternative fuels, modern energy technologies. We also administer federal funded programs, including home energy assistance and weatherization for all Minnesotans. The department also has a telecommunications unit similar to the energy area, in which we advocate for on behalf of the public interest before the telecommunications regulatory bodies, primarily the Public Utilities Commission. Staff investigates telecommunications complaints, enforces telecommunications regulations, and then it oversees the management of the TAM program, the Telecommunications Access Minnesota program. Within the department structure is also the Enforcement Division, in the next slide. Overall objectives include ensuring compliance and responsible business conduct in Minnesota, regulating broad range of licensed occupations, as I indicated. It includes insurance, it includes real estate professionals, so it's tens of thousands of Minnesotans, professional licensed individuals, and it responds to consumer complaints on a daily basis, weekly, monthly, and overall. The Enforcement Division it's broken down into three or four sections. There's the three primary ones, which are highlighted on the next slide for you. So if you envision our organization chart, there's a group of individuals that focus on civil enforcement, so this is in the area of real estate, insurance, appraisers, and a variety of other within all of the 20 industries that we regulate. If a consumer complaint comes in or problem within the industry, often it is a company that's got an issue with a particular company, and whether or not they're complying, we will look very carefully at all of that. The securities section is housed within that unit and focuses on state regulation of securities. In a way, there's a bifurcation, so the Securities and Exchange Commission regulates a certain level of securities activities, leaving primarily fraud enforcement and registration and examination of investment advisors and a variety of other topics to the states. And we actually overlap in many ways. We also have the insurance, it's the Consumer Fraud Bureau, which investigates consumer fraud. That unit is comprised of licensed peace officers conducting criminal activity involving insurance fraud and scams. Just this morning, I was out with folks of our consumer fraud enforcement. We were down in Cannon Falls talking to a group of senior citizens organized by Triad, the Sheriff's Association, that focuses on fraud and seniors and vulnerable Minnesotans. We partner with all of our federal, state, and local agencies to go after fraud and stop it. My personal perspective is that if we see it, not on my watch, and we'll do everything we can to stop it. The next slide indicates it has another broad group of what are consumer protection and other activities that the department oversees and manages. Within this area, we have the licensing staff that actually handles and processes licensing, the continuing education requirements, approvals, and all the coursework that goes into that. We also have a consumer protection services center staff. These are phone staff that are on duty every day responding to consumer complaints. It also engages in outreach activities, and when we have disasters like the tornado that blew through Minneapolis and the flooding in Duluth and the propane crisis last year, this is the team that helps us answer all the phone calls and the hotlines to get insurance claims processed, to help Minnesotans in times of need and disaster. In the next area, we talked about that, unclaimed property. It conducts outreach to Minnesotans to reconnect state residents with lost property, serves the owners of abandoned property collected by the state from the holders, including financial institutions, former employers, retailers, and other businesses. We also then all have our basically the central services within this, the core functioning to help the rest of the agency, administrative services and things like that. On the next slide, a couple of slides, we have highlighted a couple of other areas. One is an amazing unit, actually, the Weights and Measures Division, which is down in Burnsville, Minnesota. The Weights and Measures Division was established in 1885. It was and is considered the first consumer protection unit. Historically, the reason why it was created was because of the improper weighing of flour. And if you can imagine that, in 1885, it was a big issue. It would have been a big issue for our state economy, and making sure that every pound of flour delivered is exactly what it was meant to be. It's headquartered, again, in Burnsville. It ensures the accuracy in all commercial transactions based on either weight or measure. It also provides oversight and consistent quality of petroleum products. You can see a picture of one of our individuals checking to make sure that a pump is delivering the correct amount of fuel. We do that throughout the state, and you've probably seen our stickers on many of the pumps around the state. And as well, it has a precision mass, temperature, density, and volume measurement services function. It has the standards of measurement. So what weighs a pound, we know what it is, and we also have scales that will weigh trains, the size of trains, all the way down to micrograms, very small scales that you can actually barely see. The next slide is the Petrol Fund. It manages our state petroleum storage tank cleanup program, collaborates with the PCA. It's actually overseen by the Petrol Fund board that works with both of our staffs on remediation projects throughout the state of Minnesota. It contracts to remove abandoned underground petroleum storage tanks, and we staff and provide the technical support to the Petrol Fund. Those are the very high level, the major areas of functioning of the department. We have approximately 340 or so FTEs. I always am amazed by the fact that we can accomplish what we do. I always feel like we could be larger than we are, and we pound for pound do a tremendous amount of work with what we have. Turning to the next document, we have another general overview which is this one that has the fast facts on it. And our services, the first page is just sort of a general overview. It talks about some very interesting facts about the services we provide, outline some of the things I already talked about just now, and the guts of it are in the next few pages, so I'll just turn to that. Those pages on our base budget. The second page at a very it actually gives you the base budget by the program, and if you look at the highlights of the charts on the left and the bottom of the page, you'll see that our expenditures amount for fiscal year 16 and 17 of about $469 million, and it's broken out for you in a pie chart based upon the division and showing you the relationship and the percentages to the whole. And you can see that the Energy Resources Division has a large piece of this, and the answer for that is that it's federally funded dollars that are granted out and we administer and oversee. The second graph shows you the revenue. So for fiscal year 16 and 17, there is $597 million that passes through the agency in one way or another. That's federal dollars, special revenue, non-dedicated agent and agency funds. And then just to illustrate the difference in effect, the fact is that the department in a way is a net revenue generator. Revenues are above the expenditures primarily in the general fund area, as you can see. The chart at the bottom is significant to the budgeting process for our department. So even given the base budget numbers above, if you take that and you apply it to our base FTEs, you'll see that by fiscal year, it shows basically our headcounts dropping off significantly in fiscal years 17, 18, and 19. So the base budget without correction will have an impact on the department. The governor's budget addresses some of this, and as we present it to you, it's one of the things that we looked at. So as we go to the next page, sort of our objectives in all of this, sort of stepping back a little bit too. After the last legislative session, and as we anticipated being here today, in the beginning of June, I asked my staff, headed by our CFO, Tim Janke, to go through our budget, start looking at things, and we kicked off our budgeting process. We went through a series of activities to prioritize our needs and wants, and then one of them, of course, is this base budget FTE fall off, and as well some other key objectives in our budgeting process and the things that we felt would be good to do and present for budget improvements. And so with our governor's recommendation, Governor Dayton is proposing from the department several major buckets, and I'll just run through the budget objectives and then the details really on the next page, and I'll talk a little bit more about them. Our objective is to provide the essential consumer protections, again, to fund the business critical functions. And without funding, we will not be able to provide some of that. We also want to do, to protect our state's citizens and our regulated industries, particularly vulnerable and older adults, the senior citizens, and those people I was speaking to this morning, as well as others that I've talked with around the state. We want to strengthen protection for children. We want to shore up deficiencies and improve our performance in several areas. We are focused on creating flexibility within our department's budget structure in a couple of areas. And we want to fulfill our mission to protect the public interest by shoring up a couple of areas as well. On the next page, these are detailed and follow along basically with the governor's recommended changes for fiscal year 16 and 17. On the vulnerable and older adult financial protection portion of this, at a very high level, it's a proposal aimed at protecting older Minnesotans from financial abuse and exploitation, giving the Commerce Department and regulated industries additional tools to help identify, report, and to take action against suspected cases of financial abuse and exploitation of Minnesota's senior citizens. We are asking for additional staffing to help us do enforcement outreach and find and tackle the fraud to beef up our abilities. It requires regulated entities to report cases of suspected financial abuse and exploitation. I should pause here. I want to say this, and I've said before, and I spoke to the MBA and the credit unions and all this. We work and have worked with our financial institutions on in a partnership, in a collaborative basis with them to tackle financial abuse and all that. And think of this as people walking into a bank thinking they've won the lottery and somebody's convinced them to send it to Jamaica or some other country. And a credit union teller says, you know, I think that's not a good idea, and tries to stop it. I've been up in Cook, Minnesota, where I talked with them, and that exact thing did happen. We've had senior citizens who have been duped into taking tens of thousands of dollars out of their savings account. A senior citizen with the diminished capacity was convinced to take $10,000 in cash out of her account once and wire transfer that to some undisclosed location, and then to put thousands of dollars on new credit cards, and their family never found out about it until it was too late. And these financial institutions, the AARP, the Better Business Bureau, has been at my side, and we've talked with senior citizens throughout the state of Minnesota to educate them and to try to protect them so that they don't do things. In conjunction with financial institutions, I issued a guidance to them indicating there's a safe harbor under the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act. Sorry, I'm going off message here. Under the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act to advise them that they have the ability to report suspected abuse to enforcement agencies, law enforcement agencies, and they have the ability to do that. What this does is at a state level, it gives an additional space to the financial institutions to refuse to disperse funds for a transaction where they do suspect financial abuse or exploitation. Gives them a few days, 5-10 days, depending upon what kind of an institution they are, to really say, wait, no, we don't think that's a wise deal. There is a balance because customers do expect their transactions to be completed. But at the same time, we provide immunity from liability for institutions and personnel. We expand civil and criminal penalties for those who are committing civil and criminal fraud. And we develop a curriculum to provide training to regulated entities. And it would be based on programs we've already done and piloted with the Minnesota Credit Union Network Association and state credit union entities, where we have gone and talked with tellers, we've talked with people that work in credit unions on how to identify and stop financial abuse. It would raise funds, and again, we are open to raising the funds in various different ways. We went through the process of doing it in a variety of ways. We're proposing a $1 fee on life and annuity products. It creates a senior trust fund to be used for education, outreach, and training. It also models a California law that was put into place in a bipartisan, nonpartisan fashion. And then Just generally, to give you some overview of this, there's more than one in five Minnesotans who will be age 65 and older within 5 years. There will be more senior citizens in 5 years than there are children in school. And criminals know that the largest portion of wealth in the United States is in our senior citizens. And I'm talking purely criminals. I mean, these are the people who are in other countries who are targeting our senior citizens, whether it's in Jamaica or Mexico or even Canada or Russia, who are here in Minnesota every day. You talk to any senior citizen, they'll tell you they're getting robocalls every week, and they're being asked to give their money to people they don't even know. So again, with AARP, the Elder Justice Center, and the Better Business Bureau, we've put together this proposal. And again, it's in the budget for budgeting purposes. We also have health insurance rate review staffing for ongoing funding for insurance division staff that perform rate review functions for all health insurance filings. We also have health care enforcement funding, ongoing funding for enforcement staff engaged on consumer cases related to health insurance-related complaints. We also have the self-funding for the Guaranteed Energy Savings Program, which is a financing mechanism to develop energy efficiency projects for state agencies, local government units, school districts, and higher education institutions. There are 28 projects currently that are in development. The total amount of projected savings from these projects would be over $2 million. The program's goal is to maximize job creation and operational cost savings through investment in our public facilities, to reduce aggregate energy consumption by 20% throughout all state agencies. We also have an operating adjustment for additional funding for compensation related to costs associated with the delivery of agency services. There's also some funding for a one-time appropriation for costs associated with the state's defense of the Next Generation Act. We have renewable energy planning systems assessment. This is to remove what is in place, a sunset for energy planning, the energy planning and systems assessment. It's assessment on utilities. It's a representation of our interests before regional, national, and international agencies for energy policy and planning for reliability, and basically to continue the current workload and the current existing assessment. There's no additional FTEs. We just retain them.
Commissioner, I'll give you a chance to get a drink of water there.
That'd be great.
Been talking for a while. And we have a question from a member of the committee.
Yeah, maybe our staff can go for it.
Okay. So, Representative Looney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for coming today, Mr. Rothman. I have a question about the health insurance rate review.
Mm-hmm.
When we take a look at the situations, setting the politics aside regarding all the health care, it seems the primary problem is the cost of health care right now. And you hear a lot of discussions about who's actually setting the cost of health care. Is it the medical providers or is it the insurance industry? And I was just wondering if the Commerce Department in the reviews have ever reviewed or looked at the relationship the insurance industry has, the contractual relationship the insurance industry has with the medical world.
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lunin, I'll give you the short answer and then the detailed answer. from a general perspective, the department has looked into the relationship and worked in collaboration with the Department of Health. The Department of Health and the Department of Commerce split the oversight of our insurance entities, where the Department of Insurance, the Department of Commerce focuses on the insurance companies. The Department of Health looks at HMOs, basically. And we, for the Department of Health, we, the Department of Commerce, we oversee the financial aspects of the HMO. So we do that part of it for the Department of Health. And then the Department of Health looks at network adequacy, network issues. And our staff do collaborate in terms of what all the entities are doing, the trends in all of that, as well as the evolution of of the medical industry in terms of medical profession and the industry, hospital services, contracts, costs underlying the entire system. So if you think about that as the base foundation for which UI get medical care in all of us in the system, as well as the insurance aspects of it in terms of the financing of all of those transactions. So we do have a high-level perspective of that. And the more detailed answer is that in the rate review area, the rate review takes, just as an example, a filing from an insurance company on a rate proposal, and then we have a separate staff that looks at the policy itself, the actual policy. And policies review for compliance with our federal and state statutes. Mm-hmm. And then on the rate side, we look at the actuarial projections of a company for the basis of their rates and the financials, their membership, and whether or not those rates are justified. And in that process, we do look at what their projections are in terms of claims history, their costs, what's driving the costs under what the claim, what the justification is for those rate increases, including more, you know, a variety of factors, and then we look at them on a sort of a file by file approach, and whether or not they justify the rates that we approve. So on a detailed view, we wouldn't necessarily look at that relationship between the insurance company and the provider. We would know, though, in doing that, that there would be, for example, a relationship or a contractual understanding between the insurance company and their networks to cost that out, and that they're presented in an actuarial picture for us to take a look at.
Representative Luna.
Thank you. Regarding the actuarial basis of it, you know, we're in the age of big data now, and you're talking about actuarial predictions and the data that's found on over on the property casualty side. The new recipe in the algorithm of rates now is, for lack of a better term, an insurance score. So let's say, for instance, on your auto insurance, you have your driving record, you have your claims history, and now they have the insurance score. And I was just wondering, in the rate reviews or the things that drive or factor in or affect someone's insurance costs, are each company has a different recipe for what's in their insurance score. I think there's up to 41 potential ingredients in it. Some companies may use 7, I don't know, some may use all 41, but they weigh them differently, and each company is different. Is that, does the Commerce Department, when reviewing rates, do they confirm that there's an actual relationship between that when the rates are reviewed? I bring that up because when that first came into the arena, I believe the Commerce Commissioner then was Mike Hatch, and he had concerns about the transparency of that. And I'm just wondering if that gets laid on the table and reviewed.
Commissioner Rob. Chair and Representative Lunan, the department staff does, the companies do file those. They take a look at it. As a commissioner, my perspective is very similar, again, to making sure that the consumers of the state, that the state of Minnesota sees and understands what those are. So while they're filed, they're not public. They're basically, until we complete the transaction, it's or complete the review of a rate review. It wouldn't be public, but once it is, it's public information. So to the extent that folks want to look at that and take a look at it, it's available. But our staff does take a look at it, and then I should say this, that to the extent that there would be a practice that would be either discriminatory, an unjustified classification, the department would look askance at that, and we would work with companies to make sure that they are not unfairly classifying people. And specifically on the credit score, this has been modeling and a practice that's been done for many, many years. But again, to the extent that, and I'm one that has, my own perspective is that we want to make sure that if there is anything in that kind of modeling that would result in a discriminatory practice, it would be something I would not want to see.
Representative Lunan, quick follow-up, because we do have two other questions.
Yep. That information, typically a consumer is not privy to that. And I would just like your response to that reality, whether you consider that fair or not, that you're not allowed to see what's affecting your insurance rate with your insurance company.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lunan, if a consumer were to ask me, whatever company they work, they have a question about, and we have that data and it's publicly available, we give it to them. I believe that it's important for transparency, for exactly your question, that we do everything we can to do that. Now, since I've started at the department, for example, consumers, we've improved our consumer website, and we will continue to improve it so that some of this information could be potentially available, so that we can get to a place where consumers might be able to see some of this stuff in real time. They should be able to get it, access it right from their companies, but fundamentally, even my grandmother's 93 years old, isn't going to be asking for the modeling for the modeling and the of what a company has done for the pricing of their in effect, and a large portion of what the responsibility of the Department of Commerce is a public function in which we do review those things, and to the extent we can, make sure that they are that if people want the information, we'll get it to them, and in our performance of our function, to make sure that that the companies are complying with our laws.
Representative Fabian, and then we're going to allow the commissioner to finish up the budget change summaries, and then we'll go to Neuberger and Wagenius. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here. I have a couple of questions regarding, and actually maybe what we could do is schedule a meeting between you or staff or whatever, but it has to do with the Petro Cleanup Fund. Yep. And how the money is appropriated back out to the supplier, in this case, cleanup in my area, the oil company that had supplied the tanks and the fuel and so forth, had to go through the process. I guess specifically, at what point in that process does the Department of Commerce become involved in the finances and the planning of the cleanup project in partnership with MPCA, the oil company in this case, and Commerce?
Sure.
Commissioner Rothman.
If you visualize it this way, that there's a Petro Fund board, which is an appointed group, but it's actually staffed by the Department of Commerce on the sort of the financial side, on the application side, and the determination in processing of a particular claim. And then the PCA staff is doing their job on the environmental side, assessing the land, the property, and all of that. So our staff does get involved in all of that. So, at whatever point in the process, we'd be able to help you with that.
So here's my specific concern. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you. My specific concern has to do with when the project is complete, the contractor who's come out and dug the hole and they replaced the tanks and all that sort of stuff, the oil company has to pay that contractor basically now when the project is complete. But in order to get the refund, the project has to be complete. They apply for, say, 90% refund through the Petro Cleanup Fund, and there's that long delay, there's a drag in there, time delay. And if you're talking $150,000 or $60,000 on a project for a small oil company in rural Minnesota, that's kind of a big whack. So what I'm asking is can we get that streamlined and get them involved earlier in the process so that the day the project is done, they get the check from Commerce, the Petro Fund, they can cut the checks to the contractors, and off they go. So that's the discussion I want to have with you and your staff. And if something can be done through rulemaking, and you can assure me that you'll do that, fine. Otherwise, we've considered some legislation to speed up the process.
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, at any time and for any member, if there are issues like this, I would ask just you just bring them to our attention, and if we work on them on a sort of a case basis and constituent basis, we are happy to do that and facilitate those answers to your questions. If there's something that's in particular, without knowing the details and the facts,
I know that.
You know, but at the same time, I know that to the extent that, you know, if there's something that needs to be done, we'll take it seriously and see if we can't figure out what's happening there. Happy to do that.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I have a question about fraud. You talked about senior citizens with diminished capacity. I'm wondering if you could maybe help me out with a little investigation. My wife, I think, has tricked me into writing a couple of checks out to her that I'm not sure. But actually, what my question...
We're going to report that.
You can. She's listening, I'm sure.
Okay. I think it's the Department of Marital Services, Representative Fabian. But
my question has to do with, you know, I do a lot of work in Northwest Minnesota with our local community actions, and I was disappointed to hear about some of the fraudulent stuff going on down here in the metro area with one of them. You said in your comments that fraud, not on my watch. I guess, what actions have you or your agency taken with regards to the community action that I'm wondering about?
Commissioner Rothman.
Can you say the last part again?
What actions, you know, with regards to the fraud in this case, what actions are being taken with regards to the fraud that's happened with this community action that has been reported in the papers here quite a bit?
Okay.
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, you know, I should say this too. There was an incident that happened up in your neck of the woods years ago involving a fraudulent situation as well. It's called Tri-Valley. Mm-hmm. It occurred in October of 2009. The Department of Commerce auditors found out a fair amount of discrepancies in the payments in the weatherization program. It's a Crookston-based agency. And through the investigation, it determined that there was improper use of funds. And the department, after the investigation, notified Inspector General's office, and at the conclusion of the department's investigation, Tri-Valley was forced to repay over $250,000 of disallowed costs and contracts. So it's not, so the Department of Commerce, let me start from this premise, is again from a perspective of making sure that it that the funds that are distributed to the service organizations, community organizations throughout the state of Minnesota are well done. Turning to the community action in Minneapolis. In November of 2011, so if you turn back the clock a few years, Commerce staff identified numerous instances of overpayment of benefits. The benefits, if you can imagine this, were for eligible individuals, but higher than they qualified for. So they were actually, Minneapolis Community Action Agency at that time was giving more funds to eligible Minneapolis residents than they had qualified for. So they were giving additional funds to them. And when at that time our staff identified and found out that was happening, we notified the agency, that Community Action of Minneapolis, that this was a problem, and we did further investigation to determine the scope of the problem, and we implemented safeguards to protect fiscal year 2012 dollars. We spoke with the executive director in March of 2012, who had failed to comply with the program and the procedures. They lacked proper internal controls, and we advised them we would be conducting heightened oversight and monitoring, and ordered the Community Action of Minneapolis to engage and cooperate in corrective action activities. Ultimately, the Department of Commerce recovered $300,000 that was going to be spent for Minneapolis residents out of $1.3 million that was inappropriately being spent. And we had a penalty. We put a penalty of $100,000 against Community Action of Minneapolis. The Commerce Department also reviewed its monitoring procedures, its own monitoring procedures, and we implemented, under my direction, additional internal controls recommended by Baker Tilly, an audit firm, an outside audit firm that I had come in. The following year, the department, we put in commerce monitoring. We identified unreasonable delays in processing applications by Minneapolis Community Action Agency. We provided intensive training over that period of time to address the processing inefficiencies, and we directed Community Action Minneapolis to hire temporary staff from neighboring agencies to help with a backlog so that Minneapolis residents, and ultimately, again, my perspective and goal is to make sure that the recipients of the program get the funds that they're entitled to. Now, those were the activities, and I should mention that the Office of the Legislative Auditor specifically already audited that incident and the activities that we took with respect to that. And the Legislative Auditor has been in to audit the program on an annual basis, the department's program and its administration. So we have put in place, we've been recognized to have good internal controls, and we took action on that in that instance. So then the next step is that in August of last year, the Department of Human Services released its audit of Community Action of Minneapolis. It was an audit report, and it contained serious financial issues with respect to federal funds that DHS administers, and a separate program from the Department of Commerce that are administered and given to Community Action in Minneapolis, and found those funds that are administered by DHS to have been misspent. When I read the report in August of DHS's report, my staff read it, and we all huddled up to determine what would be the best actions steps going forward. Among them, there were a number of immediate steps that we started to initiate, and that included trying to determine whether any commerce funds were similarly misspent. We also looked at alternatives to make sure that that we were taking immediate action to the extent that we could. But ultimately, it led to our conclusion pretty quickly that we needed to terminate the contracts, our contracts, the Department of Commerce contracts, with Community Action of Minneapolis in both the Energy Assistance Program and the Weatherization Programs. While we were doing that, for the safety of Minneapolis residents, we identified and put into place alternative service providers to take up immediately the services that were necessary to replace Minneapolis Community Action. It was reported in the papers that the Department of Commerce went in to Community Action of Minneapolis. We obtained and seized the Department of Commerce's property, all the files for weatherization, for example. We obtained all of the financials so that we could transfer safely all of the services from Community Action Minneapolis to what we ultimately deemed was appropriate to bring in Suburban Hennepin to deliver the energy assistance. And then we also, we terminated the contract, and I should point out that that the Community Action of Minneapolis program had been in place. It's a fundamental institution, just like the programs up in your area, and had been there for 23 years, spanning administrations prior to this one, independent and Republican governors included. And it was basically when that 2011 incident happened. Under the Department of Commerce, we took it very seriously, first through closely monitoring and taking corrective actions, and then within about 1 month of the DHS audit report, terminating all of the contracts with Community Action and taking the action we did. Ultimately, stepping back from this, it felt to me that the best thing to do to protect protect the residents of Minneapolis, we needed to move quickly. the two. I should point that out. If you think about this, we were in a time frame right before the winter season, this winter, when October, November was coming on it, and we needed to make sure that funds would continue to flow or would flow to Minneapolis residents for this winter. So we took immediate steps to put all of that into place. And I want to be very clear about this. To remove any doubt about the appropriateness of the Department of Commerce's actions, it was me that asked the legislative auditor to audit the administration and management of the LIHEAP and weatherization programs leading up to those contract terminations. And to be very clear, the department is not under investigation. I sent that letter to, and I talked with the legislative auditor. And to be honest and to be frank, indeed, it is Community Action of Minneapolis that is the subject of multiple audits and investigations. And I hope that helps lay it out. We also can walk you through in more detail some of the timeline of how that happened.
Representative Newberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just to this point, as long as we're talking about this topic. So this program that we have, Commissioner, is there new funding in the governor's budget to continue this? I kind of lost this in everything you've been kind of going through here. Are we going to continue to fund this, or is this program still been terminated entirely?
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger. The funds are federal dollars that are administered by the Department of Commerce. What we mean by administering is that those are grant dollars that are then processed on behalf of 31 service providers throughout the state of Minnesota, one of which was Community Action in Minneapolis. That program, all of that funding for community action programs throughout the state is continuing. There are no state dollars, there are no state funds that we're talking about in this particular instance. And with respect specifically to the Minneapolis Community Action programming, those, although we have terminated Community Action of Minneapolis, that's that entity, that transaction, we have switched the service provider to Suburban Hennepin on the energy assistance program side. And Ramsey does the weatherization side of it. So there's other service providers in place delivering those services for Minneapolis residents, and those dollars are flowing through those programs. If I can step back and make one other additional point that I failed to point out earlier. When we terminated the contracts with Community Action of Minneapolis, the Department of Commerce as well, in partnership with the Department of Human Services, sought a court order appointment of a receiver for Community Action of Minneapolis. The court order, the court approved that receivership on November 17th. And Community Action of Minneapolis itself is in receivership. There's a receiver in place. The receiver is going through the accounts, anything that's in those within the actual entity of Community Action Minneapolis, sorting through, in essence, if you will, a receiver. It is a receivership to determine if there are funds where they should go, or if there's liabilities, what those are, and to sort that all under a court supervised process.
The Commissioner, I should know the answer to this question, but with regards to the low income heating assistance program, the grants are intended to pay for the actual energy assistance that people are getting. So in a situation like Minneapolis, unless I'm wrong, I think pretty much everyone gets their heat through electricity or natural gas through investor-owned utilities. So besides, what in that situation, when we're providing low-income heating assistance, I understand why in rural areas where you have propane storage issues and whatnot, there's administration. What do these groups do besides get the people to apply for the program? Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, very good question. And then to shed a little more light on Representative Neuberger's question, the Community Action folks think of it in terms of an entity, a place where people can apply, come in with paperwork, fill out applications, and then work with somebody to fill out and process applications for whether or not they qualify. So the eligibility side of it. So you bring in, you fill out a piece of paper, go through the income qualifications, and then the staff and the community action agencies determine whether or not. It's a manual process in many instances. So if you come into the Department of Commerce website, we'll either direct you to your local service provider, give you the 1-800 number, or figure that out for you. The funding is automated in a sense because the funding will be paid through a process to the your utility. So the money will go to pay your bill, basically. So that's kind of, there's a little bit of a bifurcation. It's a and the department oversees all of that processing, both on the of the utility transactions as well as the service provider transactions.
So the recipient of assistance goes to a service provider. The service provider processes the application. The paperwork comes to Commerce. Commerce authorizes it, and the funds go to the client's energy provider to pay the bill. Is that correct?
Well, they'll go through the approval process. We'll make sure that the approval process is being done correctly.
Okay. But is that the flow of the dollars, yeah, though, is that they go from Commerce to the energy provider, in this case, like Xcel or Minneasco?
Mr. Chair, yeah.
Okay. So I want to let the commissioner finish up his other points. I know Representative Neuberger and McGuinness both have questions, but is it okay if we just have them bullet through these really quick? So if I want to take those last couple items, then we'll finish up with questions. And my preference would be that we finish up at 2:30 and not come back later. But so, commissioner.
Yes, sir. Let me turn to decoupling the energy regulation and planning from general fund. This is modeled after what we already do in the siting and planning area. There are 21 staff in this area. We're not talking about any FTE change. It's really just changing the funding structure for the energy regulation and planning, so that we are basically decoupling, is the terminology here, from the general fund and using an assessment process and to be able to fund that. And the reason for that is that this staff is right now overtaxed. It's working on a tremendous amount of files that our utilities file, and in order to keep pace with their filings and complete them and get them done, we are asking for that flexibility to both rise when we need additional assistance and we could cut back when we don't, which is what happens in our other staffing unit. In our Commerce Fraud Bureau funding, this is increased funding for this unit. This unit was created in 2004. It works collaboratively with the insurance industry. It also receives complaints from our civil investigation from other areas and tackles the insurance fraud. It also administers the auto theft prevention program. It is already funded through an assessment formula, and there are no FTE changes that goes with this. It's simply to basically provide us with the ability and resources we need to do the improvements we have for this program. We also have the children's product rulemaking. It's a one-time funding for rulemaking to provide industry guidance on a 2013 law specifically regarding formaldehyde in certain children's products. We also are seeking an international insurance specialist. This is one new FTE to improve the ability of the department to serve the growing needs of Minnesota's foreign domestic insurers. Those are the domestic insurers that are here but are doing international and global activity with other companies within their company family, and to ensure a strong and competitive fair marketplace. Last year, the Department of Commerce participated in what we call supervisory colleges with Germany, Australia, the Dutch over U.S. domiciled insurance companies within Minnesota. And we find ourselves in a place where, while we have terrific staff, we also know that we could beef them up, and it's a necessary resource for us to keep pace with the global transactions. We also have this Petrofund tank removal eligibility expansion. It expands eligibility for reimbursement of tank removal costs when a tank removal has been ordered by the PCA as part of a approved corrective action plan. And then finally, we have the joint initiative with PCA, the Department of Health and Commerce, to support assistance in development and implementation of efforts to do education regarding priority chemicals in children's products for the public and the industry. And with that, that wraps up the presentation of those change items, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. And I did see your media appearance on CARE 11. I think it was two nights ago that there's a car dealership, not the car dealership, but an outside agency was selling some sort of warranty program. And yeah. So in a situation like that, is the Department of Commerce the enforcement agency? Is that the one that would bring... I mean, how do criminal charges get brought forward, I guess, is when, I mean, situation like that where it's clearly, this is not a view about bigger or smaller government, this is like just clearly fraud, ripping people off. Who makes that decision on criminal charges?
The department works collaboratively with either the U.S. Attorney's Office, Hennepin County, Ramsey County, or any of the county attorneys, wherever the jurisdiction is that supervises that, or other law enforcement. So... We have done presentations. We presented to the Senate Commerce Committee, and happy to do that. And we've given tours of the Department of Commerce and brought legislators in to show them what that unit does. It begins with either an investigation. Sometimes involves undercover work. But we would.
Commissioner, do you go undercover?
No. People now know what I look like, so I could put on a beard or something like that. But you know, I do have to say I'm proud of this unit. We've done some amazing things. We have worked with and prosecuted some major securities fraud investigations that are related to insurance transactions. We also have brought to and collaborated with insurance companies. So, for example, what will happen here is the insurance companies with their special investigation units will bring us and refer many, many cases to us, which we'll go through, sort them out, see if there's anything to them, and if they are and they rise to a serious matter, a criminal matter, then our folks will investigate it. And then if it becomes something that is charged out, we will work with the law enforcement and work with them to charge those individuals. And I should say this, too. I want to step back. And say that with respect to a lot of our activities, I've been invited over to some of our companies to talk with senior executives about, how we can improve things with respect to, spotting fraud, working on fraud together, working, educating senior citizens. And there is an important partnership that we have, I value, with all of our regulated institutions. We're not in the, business necessarily of saying, you're doing this bad, but if we do find a bad actor, we want to stop them. Usually it's from out of state. In that instance, it was an out-of-state company that was selling a false Ponzi scheme type warranty transaction, and then to stop it when we can.
So do you have jurisdiction outside the state then where you can, in that case, I believe they're based out of, was it Oregon, where the guy was from? I mean, how do you prosecute someone who's outside our borders, or how do you, I guess, you, in your case, you investigate and then refer to a criminal agency?
Correct. Mr. Chair, correct. And then oftentimes if it's a person or entity that's working in another state, we'll just call up the regulator in that state and we'll do a joint investigation.
With the community action stuff, is that a federal jurisdiction or a state jurisdiction that will look at that?
This one involves... primarily the Department of Commerce taking a look at and investigating this transaction. But these are federal dollars. So on the Energy Assistance Program, that is HHS funding. And so we work in collaboration with HHS staff and make sure that they're apprised of the situation. And then as well on the weatherization side, those are Department of Energy funds, and we work with them on anything that would be happening in that area, too.
So you guys work, so both departments work together then?
Yeah.
So is there a criminal investigation in that right now, going into what's going on? Not at the commerce level or DHS, but at the community action?
Mr. Chair?
I'm
I should refrain from answering that question.
Okay, all right. Representative Neuberger, you had a...
No.
Representative Wagenius?
Thank you. Just on a totally different note here. When I look at the weatherization assistance program number, I just have no context of, is this a big amount for the need or a small amount for the need? So I come back to a more basic question, and that is, in our housing stock, do we have a way to measure our inefficiency, and or to think of it the other way, do we know how much fuel we are using in, or energy we're using in Minnesota because of inefficiencies in housing stock?
Commissioner Rothman.
And you don't have to answer that now, but if there's a way to get at that, I would appreciate it. Yeah. I think other folks might be interested. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, the answer is yes, in a general fashion. We can give you that information and, you know, kind of what is it that a home would look like, what kinds of homes we're talking about, what is the housing stock that we're looking at, what homes have been tackled and what priority and what might be remaining, and then probably from a global level as well, just general data. So I'm happy to, I'll have our staff reach out to you and work with you.
I think it's just, we work on these kinds of things. I have trouble if I don't have context. And we need some sort of context for weatherization and for efficiency for housing stock. And that's just all across the state. I mean, we have some very old housing stock in your district, and mine. So.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. Very good report. I guess I'm looking more at the governor's changes in the budget when it comes to the operating increase. And on page 16 of the detail, I see there's a very large increase this year with your operating, actually in 16 and 7 between 16 and 17. The footnotes, if I could use those, are really kind of focusing on about the 1.8% increase, I think, for overall employee compensation and related cost to employees. I know there's been obviously recent discussions a lot about the commissioners' salaries increases. My question would be maybe a little bit further down the line under your deputy commissioners and assistant commissioners, are they under the 1.8% as well? I'm just trying to know also, this 1.8% doesn't add up to the large change between 16 and 17 in the budget that the governor is proposing here. So, and as a person who doesn't see this very often, this is a new thing for me. I'd love your explanation. Thank you.
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Baker, there are several questions in there, so, and I'm happy to follow up if I miss anything or if you have other detailed questions. First of all, over the last couple of biennium, the staff of the department have, and it's actually with all state agencies, have had the opportunity to do some minor increases in two shots, so that deputy commissioners, assistant commissioners, and managers, the managers of the department, have received incremental increases. I think it's where we at? Was it 3.5? Yeah, 3.5 in two bites. And then we, so that's that part of the question. The second piece of this is that without the this funding, without the operational funding, you think of it in terms of FTE counts, and I think we're talking about in fiscal year 16 the equivalency of 3, and in fiscal year 17, 6, if I'm not mistaken, 6. For which we need to retain, and without that funding, would have to cut, and so that's really what the purpose of that change item is for. The next piece of it, I can't remember if I've answered all your questions, but I think that kind of gets at the point of what the need is for.
Good, Representative Baker.
Just a follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. So we're going to add more staff, basically double the staff in that area to help retention, take the pressure off the current workload, but still maintaining roughly a 2% increase as to what the budgets or what the governor's proposing. Am I reading that sort of correctly to take the load off the current workforce?
Representative Baker, where do you see the doubling of staff? Where was that?
Mr. Chair, that's what I think the commissioner just said, that next year in 17 he's going to go from 3 FTEs in 16 to 6 FTEs in 17. Am I correct?
Yeah, Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, no. It's the opposite. It's that there are not new staff. There aren't no additional staff. It's basically that if we do not get the funding, we would have to cut 3 staff in fiscal year 16 and then 3 more the following year. So that would be total 6 after two fiscal years.
That helps. Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Rothman, on page 11, you have the change item on the health insurance rate reviewing staff, 6 FTEs. And it's my understanding from reading it that that has to do with the Affordable Care Act and what goes on at MinSure and so forth. If we're adding 6 FTEs there, what would be the qualifications of someone who's going to be a health insurance rate review staff member?
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the qualifications are the same as what they currently are. And we, again, are not adding staff. We are retaining staff. So it would be the same people we currently have.
I understand that. Yeah. I am asking, what are the qualifications of people who are reviewing the rates?
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, these include actuarial, health policy experts who look at all of the federal and state basically requirements and guidance and laws and regulations in all of this area, both on the rate side and on the policy side. People who review the actual policy forms, so the people that are kind of looking through the actual policies themselves, and I believe sort of a health the analysts, so analysts, not just the actuaries, but people who have the analytical skills.
So Commissioner, like actuarial, insurance, and finance, maybe some health insurance background stuff.
Exactly. Plus we have specifically, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, we have position descriptions with all that detail for all these positions.
Sure. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then also, you know, there was, I'll say, some controversy with regards to MinSure and Preferred One and the rates and all that sort of stuff. Are the rates set, or are they kind of dictated to the companies? How does that all happen through this rate making process? Are they told what the rates are going to be, or do they submit the rates?
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, they are filed. Each company files the rates with the department. The companies have their own actuaries, their own financial folks, their own analysts, model what they want to do in terms of marketing insurance products and what rates they want to charge Minnesotans for. They have to file those with the Department of Commerce in the rate review process, which is set out by statute and our staff look at and review whether or not the rates are reasonable or not. Are they reasonable or not? Did the actuaries that the companies use do a good job? Are they unjustified? Going back to Representative Lunan's question earlier, is there discrimination in them? Are they is it properly, are the classifications proper? And in many times they're not. Many times the actuaries are including inappropriate assumptions or aren't assuming things that they should be assuming. And so what the department does will work with the companies to come to a place where they are more reasonable. If after that review the department decides they're not reasonable, then we would object, and we would determine that in some instances we would deny it or approve them. And it's an approval or acceptance by the department of what the companies have filed.
Representative Fabian, last question.
Yep, last. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So after the rates were announced, and then they kind of came up with the 4.5% average in part of the state that I represent, that certainly wasn't an accurate number. Have you adjusted that number? I mean, does the Commerce stand by that 4.5% rate increase, or is that something that I've missed a change somewhere in reflecting maybe a more accurate number from my perspective?
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we can get you the accurate numbers for your area, we're happy to do that. And in fact, when we released the information, we did put out the accurate information for your area. And we put it out in every ratings area for the state of Minnesota with respect to each of the products, or each of the rates that were sold for each of the product levels for every rating area and by every company. So specifically with respect to the number that we put out, to be very clear, was an average of the four companies who were returning to the exchange for this year. And that number was based on a weighted average that each of those companies had done for all of their products. So with respect to that, it was a straightforward number. And we're happy to, if you need them, go through your rate area.
So we're going to wrap up here. We're out of time, Representative. Sorry. But first of all, I wanted to congratulate the commissioner, because I don't know how you did it. You got through testimony without Representative Neuberger bringing up the $1 million for appealing the Next Generation Act enforcement in North Dakota. I don't know how you did it, but good job. The second thing is, Commissioner Grant, if you're available, if I just talk to you afterwards for a couple minutes. And then third, I just wanted, we talked about this during lunch, and, different people have different philosophies on the size and scope of government, but fraud is something that we all hate. And I really, hopefully when session's over, I'd really like to get over there and see your fraud division in action. I know you got a lot of hardworking people over there, and just please keep catching these people, because they really do. I mean, technology is a great enabler of information, but it also gives the bad guys some access to information that they misuse and hurt. And I just thank you and your staff for all that work you're doing, and please, people who are cheating, ripping off the system, who are using fraud to either rip off the taxpayers or to rip off victims, please, you can't hit them hard enough, and it strengthens the integrity of the programs when we catch these people, so please enforce away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, with that, members, we are adjourned. Thank you, Commissioner.